lovely word. I'd just like to prefer... Welcome to another episode of the Dawn of Shades. I'm your host, Gia Scott, and today is May 16th, 2012. We're continuing our Native American Voices series with another program, another story, and another point of view tonight in our sixth program of the series. But before we get started, let's start off with some information and reminders. Our website, thanks to a lot of hard work and aggravation on Greg's part, is now back up. Pages are still missing, but they will be rebuilt as fast as humanly possible. The even better news is that after all that aggravation and all of the irritation, we're still married and not negotiating for a divorce. So that's really good. Now, for you foodies out there, we are still also working on our cookbook project. Get those recipes sent in to me at my email for inclusion as soon as you can. We're really hoping for this to represent all of our listeners and guests, so please send in the recipes and don't wait till the last minute. Editing this project is also a big task, so the sooner I have them, the sooner I can get things put together. Now, for tonight's programs, just like all of our programs, I would love to have the audience's input with questions and comments. If you have joined the virtual auditorium in PalTalk, you can send them to me via text. And if you're listening through one of the other venues, you can email them to me at gscott@exogenynetwork.com. This is true even if you're listening in on a rebroadcast or podcast of this program, so please, if you enjoyed it, drop me a quick line and tell me so. If you didn't enjoy it, well, drop me a line anyhow and tell me why. So, moving right along, tonight we're fortunate enough that we're being joined by Sheldon Wolfchild, along with some very interesting topics ahead. And hopefully my co-host, Keith Sekola, will join us at some point during the program. So, to start it off, Sheldon, would you introduce yourself to the audience, please?
Yes, my name is Sheldon Wolfchild. I'm from the Dakota Nation, from the state of Minnesota. And I live on the Lower Sioux Indian Nation here in Minnesota. And so that's where I'm from.
Okay. Now, just because not everybody knows where the Lower Sioux Reservation is located, you know, what part of the state is it in? What's close by, if they want to look at a map and find it?
Yeah, it's southwest of Minneapolis-St. Paul, about 110 miles southwest of Minneapolis and St. Paul, right on the Minnesota River. And I'm on the reservation that was established here in 1851, and I'll be talking tonight about how we got here on our reservation, and basically about the Dakota people in Minnesota, and what happened 150 years ago to all of our Dakota people in the state of Minnesota, and that's what I would like to be talking about tonight.
Now, I happen to be a little bit familiar with Minnesota. I was actually born in Minnesota in the southwestern portion, a little further south and west where you're at, but, you know, so I'm a little bit familiar with what the country is like, and so why don't you start off by just giving us some general history of the Dakota people. Not everybody knows that much about their history in that area.
Yeah, that's very true. Well, we there are four bands in Dakota, in our Dakota, with our Dakota people, and I'm from the Mid-Wahkatoon band. And there's also Wapakute, Sisseton, and Wahpeton band. So there are four bands of Dakota, originally from Minnesota. And what I've been studying for researching and filming, and I'm a filmmaker. And I've been doing a documentary on the War of 1862, which this year is 150 years since that war. And what happened 150 years ago was that it was the climax of the cause, the largest mass execution in American history of 38 Dakota men. And so a lot of people around in the U.S. and in Canada, and for that matter, I assume in Europe, don't know about this. And so this year is 150th year that since that war, and my documentary deals with the cause of that war and who really caused that war. And it's really a story that needs to be told, and which is why I'm doing the documentary. It's it'll be probably about a two-hour documentary. The first segment deals with the 1862 war that I was talking about, but it's the cause of the war that has never been really put in the history books and in the educational books. As to the government of Minnesota, the United States government, and dealings with the Dakota people, and for that matter, the dealings with all indigenous people across this country. And it was a system, it was an Indian system that they set up, which was a process of treaty making. And so the documentary deals with this Indian system of how, through treaties, with a government to government, the indigenous people's government with the United States government, we signed legal treaties in good faith from our Dakota people, and an agreement that said basically, yes, here in Minnesota, we're going to be giving up like over 3 million acres of land, and in turn we'll be getting the monies made from our land would be reimbursed to our people, and we'd also be given tracts of land on each side of the Minnesota for almost 100 miles, which was 10 miles on each side of the river. And so through the treaty agreements, the government was bound by their treaty agreements to uphold this agreement and also protect the rights of the Dakota people in this treaty. And if there was any laws violated against the Dakota people, then the government would correct those violations. And that's basically what happens with the treaty system. So we have to go back to the origin, beginning of the treaty system back in 1803 with President Jefferson, when he stated we must continue to build government trading posts in the West. By doing so, we cause the chiefs and sub-chiefs to go into debt, and to pay off their debts, then they are willing to lop them off for a succession of lands. And so there entailed their strategy from Thomas Jefferson of how to get the treaties, and by forcing the indigenous people into debt, and then they would get the lands from that, through the treaties, through the debt. So this is the part of the Indian system that began in 1803. And so the consequences of that, of course, was the process through this system of starting, you know, of course, with the indigenous people from back east to the Midwest, and then to the Minnesota area and the Mississippi River. An example of that is in the Midwest, in Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, Michigan, they would establish territorial governors. The United States government would. And through these territorial governors, then, they would work with the agents and then the traders, because the agents and traders knew the indigenous people in those particular areas. And so, through the territorial governor, then they would have these agents set up a process with the tribes to have to get their lands through treaties. And once they got the lands and through the treaties, then in those treaties they would state so many years from now you will be required to move the west of the Mississippi. And of course it was the hope of the indigenous people they wouldn't have to. But every treaty that was signed, every time the U.S. signed a treaty with the indigenous people, they would always change the wording and the language of the treaty after it was signed. So they would always make sure in the treaty that it would always be the president of the United States would always have the last word. And so when the treaty got back to Washington, then, of course, whatever would benefit the United States, the language would be changed. And then when that got back to the indigenous people and the chiefs and sub-chiefs and their respective delegation, of course they would be angry about it, because that wasn't the original intent of what we signed here. So that was the process of the system. And so the government really never had any intention to fulfilling these. It was just a mechanism to ultimately get all the land across the Midwest through the western states to the Pacific coast.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens then once the territorial governors get the agents and the traders to get the indigenous tribes to sign these treaties, then eventually they're moved. Well, that happened with in Minnesota. And
uh-huh.
for an example, in 1841, the state requested territorial governor Doughty of Wisconsin.
4803.
Go ahead.
Okay, requested a territorial governor of Wisconsin to do to get a treaty signed in Minnesota, in a southwestern part by a town named Mankato, and their intention was that all of the tribes in Illinois, Indiana, Michigan, Ohio, the treaties they had signed 20 or 30 years prior to that has now required them to be removed from that area west of the Mississippi. And so what happened then was they had Territorial Governor Doughty of Wisconsin contact a well-known agent in Minnesota territory. His name was Henry Hastings Sibley. Mr. Sibley was head of the American Fur Trade. He came to Minnesota in 1834, became head of the American Fur Trade. He was also an attorney. His father was a Supreme Court territorial judge from Michigan. And so Mr. Sibley then had a background in law. And so he became the head of the American Fur Trade in Minnesota and through Canada, and worked with the French and the British through that process. And then in 1838-39, the fur trade dwindled. And so as a trader, he turned to being a land speculator. He had already got to know Dakota people in Minnesota, Minneapolis, St. Paul area, and through other areas, and got to know all the tribe, the different bands, so to speak. But primarily the Mittawakaton band and Wapakuti band, he knew them very well. So what his intention was then was to get land, and so when the opportunity came to him by territory of Governor Dottie of Wisconsin to have a treaty signed to remove the people from the indigenous people from the states in the Midwest of Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, he then got together three bands of the Dakota, the Siskin, Wapton, and Wapakuti, which is, and signed a treaty about 100 miles south of Minneapolis in a town called Mankato. And so in 1841, they signed this treaty of over 3 million acres, and they were going to remove all the tribes from the Midwest across the Mississippi and put them in this area by Mankato, along with the Dakota people. And Mr. Sibley would be put in charge of the head agent to use his other traders, his old trader friends. He would be in charge of the old trader friends to cover all this land territory for trade, and as well as getting the money from the treaties for the land, that he would be in charge of that as well. And the system that began the system, the Indian system right there. So what happened then was it was all set up, and then 2 years later, this had laid idle in Washington. In 1843, they took it. They took this in the Senate. They talked it over, and a senator from Missouri, he was into the land. He was a land speculator as well. He was an expansionist. Anyway, he disagreed with having this treaty signed. He says, we do not want to have more indigenous people come into this area to have this process done, because the land is too fertile in Minnesota. And so for that reason, we should not allow these other tribes to be included in Minnesota, and therefore we should deny this treaty. And so the Senate went along with them. The land was too fertile and rich. It was black gold, so to speak. And so the ultimate goal was to get the frontiers people to have that land. That was their goal. That's why the senator Mitch said that. And so it was denied in 1843. So 5-6 years later, all of a sudden, the same man, Mr. Sibley, has a friend called Alexander Ramsey. And so he got with Alexander Ramsey, and they planned another treaty to get this time all the Dakota Sioux land in Minnesota. And Mr. Sibley understood thoroughly how the process, after all, he wrote up the 1841 treaty and understood that once, if he can get a 51 treaty done now, he'd be all set. And so he got together with Alexander Ramsey. They worked with the Dakota two bands in southwestern Minnesota, the Siston Wapitins, and formulated their first treaty in at Traverse des Sioux in Mankato, St. Peter area, again down in the Mankato area. In 1851, they had their first treaty signed. And so they set up the whole language. They wrote the language in the treaty. And then 2 weeks later, they went to Minneapolis area where the Mittawakanton and Wapakuti bands were. And they had a treaty there of Mendota of 1851 signed with the same language. One of our chiefs from the Mittawakanton people by Minneapolis went down to the treaty signing, the first one in Mankato there, to try to listen in to see what this was about. The one at the treaty of Traverse des Sioux in Mankato, St. Peter. But they kicked him out. They wouldn't allow him in there, one of our chiefs, because they didn't want him to go back to our people in Minneapolis and say, this is what their plans are. We better think about this, whether we should do this or not. They didn't want them to have him to have the rights to sit in and listen to what their plans were in the treaty language. So 2 weeks later, then, they both signed the treaty at Mendota and Minneapolis-St. Paul area, and we gave up over 3 million acres, millions of acres. I forget the exact amount now, but and so what happened from that then was we were given 10 miles of land on each side of the Minnesota River, close to Mankato, all the way up to the border of South Dakota today, which is about 100 and some miles. So the Mittawakanton and Wapakuti bands would have the first 50 miles on each side of the river, and the Siston Wapitins would have the other part. And so this began the Indian system, and and so the monies that from the treaty that we signed for our land, that money then was to be used and to when the settlers came in the area and they would buy those parcels of land, that money would be sent to Washington, and then that money was supposed to go into United States bonds for the stock market. And the proceeds from the stock market sales then would be given to the Dakota people once a year. They would get a percentage off of the stocks. Mm-hmm. So that was the intention. And of course, Washington never once they entered that in the stock market, they never watched how the stocks were, if they were accumulating any money or making any, they never watched it. So when it started at a certain high level, and then when it dipped and got lower, they didn't sell the stock. They allowed it to continue to get lower and lower and lower until the stocks became useless. They lost, they didn't get any profits off the stocks, and that was Washington, and that was their responsibility. So, So what happened then in the treaties, in the Indian system then, so the money that would come here every year, once a year, there would be, the treaty agreement was that we would get so much money a year from our land, as well as foods for the people, and schooling, education, and housing process. They would give the Dakota people farm tools to plow for become farmers, and so in 1853, then they removed us because the money in Washington didn't come get approved until for us to be removed from Minneapolis and St. Paul until 1853, 2 years later. So we walked from Minneapolis to St. Paul to Lower Sioux, to 110 miles from Minneapolis, southwest of there. And we set up our governance and our whole reservation here. Mittawakatins and Wapakutes and Assistant Wapatins were up a little north of us. And so
now, you know, a lot of people, you know, that are listening to you talk about this history, their only impression of what kind of lifestyle the Dakota people lived before the treaty that put them on the reservation is coming from Hollywood. And I grew up in that area, and the Dakota people were never mentioned in our history, not in the state history, not in anything. Now, granted, I was on the south side of the Iowa border, but I know that the Dakota people ranged that far south, too. So what kind of lifestyle did they have prior to being moved to this reservation? You know, were they really hunting buffalo and that was about it? Did they live in teepees? You know, what kind of a life was it before, and what kind of changes did it mean for those people who were moved into this reservation situation?
Okay, but our original way of governance and living, a way of life, was in Minnesota. We had in Minneapolis, St. Paul area, where our Mittawakatin people were. We had everything there. We have the lakes around us, the Minnesota Mississippi River, where they meet. That was the center for our people, our creation area there. It's called Bedote. And all around that area were lakes, the rivers, of course, the hunting from the forest were right there, and the plains were right next to us. So we had the buffalo to the west, the forest to the east and north, and all the lakes and rivers. And then we planted corn, squash, beans. We were semi-sedentary as a band of Dakota. And so what we did was, we had our own governance through our spiritual sacred history, and so through that governance, we were taught how to maintain a life of respect for one another, how to treat one another, how to walk as a Dakota every day, is what our system was about, and so that's what it's about. We shared everything. We were a community of sharing. And so we were used to this process. Originally, we had pottery. So we used pottery for our women would cook in pottery. We would make wooden spoons, of course, and different things. So that was our system. And then in the 1660s, the French came to our area. And with them, they brought guns and knives, the metal pots, and so our Dakota women then liked the metal pots. They were more firm, of course, all that goes with it. So they changed to the metal pots. We got the guns and the bullets, the knives, and so our system, our prior way of system of living changed at that time in the 1660s with the French. And the French also, not only, they also brought a system called the Doctrine of Discovery, and I can get into that later. And so, so our people, what they did was they had their fields. They would grow their plants in the summertime, spring and summer. They had their village area in Minneapolis and St. Paul, and they would live in. They had teepees as well as wood structures, and they would use bark. They were kind of like huts, and so they would have hut homes with wood, and then they would put bark around that, and they would live in there from 2 to 3 to 5 families. They're that big, so they had both ways. And so in the summertime, we lived in those wood type of homes along with the teepees, and then in the fall and winter, we would go from there to a different area to hunt for the winter. And so that's why we were semi-sedentary. So in the winter, we would take the teepees to a hunting area where it's going to would be good for that, all the village people, and set up our village for the winter.
Uh-huh.
And then in the spring, of course, they what guided their process was the stars. They would watch the stars and the solar system and all that. All those stars had a specific meaning to them. So when, as through the winter seasons came, the solstices, they would watch that and they would know then to go back to their original area to get ready to go and move back to the original home and for the spring, summer, and fall. So that's kind of the system we had originally. And so,
I do have a question from the virtual auditorium for you. And it comes from Nylily, and she's wondering whether they're bringing back their traditional ways of life, especially their spirituality and language.
Oh, yeah. We've only had our right to practice our ceremony since 1978. Congress passed the Indian Freedom of Religion Act in 1978, I should say. So we've had 33 years now to finally be able to have our ceremonies and not be arrested. And so it's taken a while for our people, a lot of our people that have been left out in our ceremony and understanding that process. They've been left out because of the fear factor and because of the law. They didn't want to be put in prison or in jail. And so we've had a short time now to get back to our ceremonies, but our elders and holy people fortunately kept our ceremonies and spiritual understanding hidden. And they would have they would hold their ceremonies in private at different times. And so through our oral sacred history, they preserved that knowledge. And that's what we have today. And so that has been over the years, that has been written down in many areas with our people and preserved so that we've also have their oral written history written down from years ago. Because our people were afraid to tell the government anything because, especially in Minnesota, our Dakota people, we were on the run after the War of 1862. They had scalps of $25 to $200 on any Dakota person found that they would pay. If you'd kill a Dakota person, you'd have to scalp them, bring that scalp to Minneapolis, and they would... and show the Minneapolis and U.S. government that here's the scalp, then they would pay you. And so our people scattered after the war. But back to our original way of life, we have always had a beautiful way through our spiritual way of understanding. And that has never lost, we have never lost that because our elders have taken care of that for us. But it's been slowly coming back because we've only had the right since 1978 to practice our ceremony. So that's what happened in that term, in that area. But it still goes on today. We could, like our elders say, we could live today like we lived 300-400 years ago. We still have our life. Of course, a lot of it has been lost, but it's coming back. And we have our ceremonies. That's still here. We're getting stronger in that way. And we still have our oral story.
For a lot of people, it's really hard to imagine that the whole concept, one of the concepts that this country was founded on was freedom of religion. And yet that was a basic thing denied to indigenous people.
Exactly, yeah. The First Amendment. The First Amendment of freedom of rights for freedom of religion have been denied us until 1978.
We had another guest earlier in the series, and he talked about, as he was learning about various religious or ceremonial practices, that it was all done in a very secretive manner because they would have the FBI. They couldn't openly arrange for a meeting with these various elders because the FBI would have arrived. And, you know, I think there's a lot of people who just still find that so very hard to believe. And yet that was a very real thing, wasn't it?
Very real thing. Exactly. They were, like I said, 1978 gave us the right to practice our ceremonies. Prior to that, it was illegal. So they had a tremendous hold on our people and our elders. What our elders had to face all those previous years. It was just a tremendous, tremendous, terrible thing that they had to go through, and then survive.
Well, my understanding is that with most tribes, the religion isn't like a lot of religions where you spend one day a week or a few hours in a specific location practicing a religion. Your religion is actually almost a way of life, and so these ceremonies and these practices enter into daily life. So to have those things forbidden, it was almost as though they were attacking the core of your culture, wasn't it?
Well, exactly what it was. We don't have a religion. We have a spiritual way of belief, and so the natural life that the Creator gave us in all elements of life that He created on Earth, that is the great spirit, and so that's the way we communicate. We understand, respect all life: the trees, the plants, the water, those that live in the water, the wingans. Those are relatives, because without them, we couldn't survive as two-legged. Like my elders, the elders say, if the plants and everything died and the water disappeared or we couldn't drink the water, how long would the two-leggeds last in this country, in this world?
You know? Not too terribly long, you know?
No, not too long, and that's our point. That's their point. That's why
everything's interconnected, interdependent, and I think society and science is really finally kind of grasping that concept.
Yeah, and if we're going to be able to survive in this world, everybody has to step forward and respect the Earth, respect all life on this Earth, because it is being poisoned. And the only way she's going to survive is to correct that poison. And so the Earth has to make its changes and to survive because of all the poison that's being put in her now. So we are definitely at that point in time. So we as human beings have to stop and say, wait now. We better respect this Earth, our Mother Earth here, respect all the life that was put on her from the beginning, like the indigenous people have always done. And because we believe in that way of life and spirit understanding, we have been totally not listened to because of course, Christianity. And that's another whole topic that we can talk about later, but that's the reason why we haven't had our ceremonies. The laws and the people who run the United States are going to protect their belief system and not protect the indigenous belief system. And so when you consider that element, that money against the natural laws has been what our indigenous people have always faced. Our beliefs in protecting the earth is going against profit motive. Profit motive of making more money. They're not satisfied with a 20% or 50% profit. They're not satisfied with a 500% profit or 1,000% profit. They want 2,000% profit. That's the mentality we're up against. That's terrible. And who suffers? The earth. And so,
mm-hmm.
What's going to happen to our children? What's going to happen to our children if we don't protect the earth? They're not going to have any profits. And so that's what we've been up against. And so, of course, the system in Washington with the profit motive process and was brought over here from the European area. You know, that's been the crux of the matter. And so,
what started you on the journey to make a documentary?
The journey is what happened to our Dakota people from in the War of
1862. But what made you decide to actually start the project? That happened quite some time ago, but nobody else has done it. I mean, I grew up in that area, and the closest I ever came to learning anything about Dakota history was being told about the Spirit Lake Massacre in northern Iowa.
Yeah.
That was it.
Yeah, and that's exactly why I'm interested in telling this story, because our story in Minnesota has never been told for 150 years. It's been a cover-up because the system in Minnesota, they only want to put in the books that for education books their process of the way of the history of the United States. They want to show that the Indian people were heathen savages, and therefore we had a right to take their land because they brought war upon us. And so that's been the teaching here in Minnesota all these years. They've never put in the real history of how this war happened, who really started the war, which was the government system. So that's why it's a shock now with this documentary. I got this segment 98%, 99% done on the cause of the War of 1862, because I have shown this to a few college students who are studying the war system, and a few groups of people. I also showed it to 2 weeks ago on May 1st to the clergy, the Episcopal clergy, and the Bishop of Minnesota.
Mm-hmm.
We got a standing ovation from this piece. They never knew the real history. It was not told in this manner to them ever. And so that's the effect. And when I showed this to the college students, they were appalled. They were saying, why wasn't this history in our history books? I'm born and raised here. Why did I never hear this in our history books of what really happened here in Minnesota to the Dakota people and the system that went on to cause this war? They were saying, I am embarrassed and ashamed of what happened here.
I graduated from high school in a town named Sibley after the same guy responsible for hanging so many people.
Yes.
And yet, not even that was taught in school. It wasn't brought up how we got the town's name. Other than, it was named after General Sibley, blah, 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 blah. And that was the extent of it. There wasn't any mention about hanging anybody. And the closest, conversation about Indians, like I said, it would be, a field trip to Spirit Lake, Iowa, and they put the Spirit Lake Massacre between the Coke plant and the Lay's plant, that was it.
Mm-hmm.
And as an adult, I know there's always two sides to a story. And the incident that occurred in Spirit Lake with those settlers, there was another side to the story.
Oh, yeah, definitely another side.
Yeah.
If you want to get into that, the man that attacked those settlers, forgive me. What you mentioned his name earlier. Anyway, the reason what happened with him, he was a part of our Mitawaka, our Wapakuti band here.
Mm-hmm.
But what happened was he was out there hunting buffalo in that area, and with his own family and others, and a trader that was selling whiskey killed his mother and his brother. And so he went to the, because he was a treaty, his people signed the treaty, he was supposed to be protected under the treaty laws. And when he went to the government officials, they did nothing to this man that killed his mother and his brother that was selling whiskey to people. And so for that, he got revenge. He wanted to get revenge then. He tried and tried to get a proper way of getting that man arrested and for killing his mother and his brother, and they did nothing. Nothing at all to that man. And so he went to war. And so that's the story about him. And what does the government do? They tell our chief, Little Crow, to go after this man and bring him in, or we're going to hold back your annuities and your money. You're not going to get that this summer if you don't find him and bring him back. And so he went out. Okay, then I'll go look for him. He went out to find him. He couldn't find him. He came back and said that I did my best in the proper way. It was my duty. We signed the treaty. I went to look at it for him. We could not find him. And so our chief got blamed for not finding him. Another excuse. So that's the story about, his name is Impaduta. I think that's the name of that chief. I think that was the name of his chief. I'm sorry, but so anyway, that's that story. But anyway, getting back to this whole process of not being told in the history books, you have the Minnesota Historical Society here. They're the ones that hire the anthropologists and the writers, the historians, to write the history. And who became the head of and started the Minnesota Historical Society? Henry Hastings Sibley in 1848.
Uh-huh.
3 years prior to the 1851 treaty. So who controlled the content of the truth? Henry Hastings Sibley and whoever else he brought in to write that history. That's how it started. And so here we are 150 years later, not ever told the real truth of how this ever happened, because the first governor of the state of Minnesota was Henry Hastings Sibley in 1858.
So it's this documentary is going to be about 2 hours long, and it's going to present the history from the Dakota point of view.
Exactly. It's the history from our point of view as to the war could have been prevented. An example, in 1862 in January, or actually in 1861, the federal government, the head of the Indian Affairs Committee in the Senate and the House, requested the Secretary of the Interior and the Indian Commissioner in Washington to do an investigation as to the Indian system in Minnesota, because there was law being violated and money being stolen. So they sent an agent from Washington to give them, they gave them 100 days to investigate the laws and fraud being violated in Minnesota by agents from the government. He did a thorough investigation. He found out, he got half of the papers that these agents and traders would put this is the job they've done, so we need to get reimbursed, or receipts for reimbursement. Anyway, that was spread all around to all the agents, the traders, and on up the ladder from the superintendent of the Indian Affairs in Minnesota. They were all reaping all the money from the treaty money. They were getting they were making hundreds of thousands of dollars in 1850s, when their payment was $1,500 a year. They were becoming rich.
Well, hold on to that idea, because we have run out of time in this first half. Folks, the first half of the Dawn of Shades tonight has come to an end. It's time for our break. Hold on to your own patience and serenity, and we will be right back with our guest, Sheldon Wolfchild.
But anyway, from Rock and Roll Group, there's a song called Listen Now.
Thank you. I am the ambassador of Native music. You are listening to Donna Shades, the Native American Voices series. I'm your co-host along with Gia Scott. The program runs from April 10th to June 5th, Tuesdays, 7 to 9 p.m. Central Time. Join us and special guests each week as we discuss topics relevant to Native America today. How it affects all of us. How do we go forward without forgetting the past? How do we heal? How do we live a good life? Please join us each week as we discuss topics important to Native America today. Hoka, Bindigain, come in.
Dawn of Shades. I'm Gia Scott, and tonight I'm joined by Sheldon Wolfchild, and we have been talking about many, many things, and, you know, I've been learning even more while we were on break. Sheldon, there's so much that I'm not sure we can even begin to cover at all in the time we have left to us, but why don't we jump ahead to the Treaty of 1858, and how that led to the War of 1862.
Yeah. The Treaty of 1858 was signed by our Dakota chiefs. What happened was there was an agent here, Agent Brown, secretly gathered the chiefs here in Minnesota, the Dakota chiefs, and said, "We're going to Washington." And so the chief said, "Okay, we want to go there because we want to talk to the authorities in Washington about the treaties, the 51 treaty and others that haven't been properly respected and how we haven't gotten the money for our land and the food that was supposed to be given to us, all those things." They wanted to talk to Washington. Well, what they weren't told was they were in there secretly to sign another treaty. And so when they got to Washington, they started getting papers all around our chiefs, and they were asking, "What is this?" They're saying, "Oh, what we're going to do is we want to have you to sign another treaty to take, this treaty will take, we want to take the land that's on the north side of the Minnesota River, the 10 mile strip, 10 miles wide and 100 and some miles long. We want to take that for the government to have, and we'll figure out what we'll pay you for that land." And so they were astounded. We weren't brought here to sign a treaty. But they kept them there for several weeks. Finally, they gave in and they signed it. And so they came back home and because they were by that time they didn't have much money, they weren't hardly getting any money from the 51 treaty. So they thought, well, then we'll get more money and be able to get through this selling of this acreage, we'll have more money to live on and more annuity payments and more food for our people. And so in the language in Article 6 in the 1858 treaty, it states that the Dakota must continue to respect the Minnesota citizens and cause no harm or injury to their person or property, their land. But if they do go to war and fight, have any harm done to them, then the monies from the treaty of these treaties will be reimbursed to these people who have lost or damaged their property. That money will be used for that purpose. And on the bottom of Article 6, it states that, and if there are any of these warriors that cause damage or harm or killings of any settlers, then any Dakota people that are there must help the United States and the Minnesota and the state of Minnesota to round up these people and bring them in for to trial. And so Bishop Whipple, who is the bishop, well, Episcopal bishop here in Minnesota that was here at Lower Sioux, and along with his associate Reverend Hinman, were defenders of the Dakota people and went to Washington and told them that they were being wronged, that the money has been being stolen, there's fraud and laws are being broken, but Washington wouldn't listen to them. So Bishop Whipple stated that the do-nothing policy in Washington is in effect. Well, you consider the language of Article 6. All they had to do in Washington and Minnesota was to sit back and do nothing, allow our young warriors to watch their parents, their children, their elders starve, because the federal agents would not open up the warehouses to feed them, because the agents and the traders wanted their money first before they would feed them. And so the agents and traders are making big profits off the Indian system, and they didn't want, and so they're waiting for their reimbursement of the gold in August that they brought every year. And so the do-nothing policy in Washington was all set up, because they knew sooner or later that the young warriors would not take any more and they would cause a war. And that's exactly what happened. And they allowed that to happen. And so that's what the Article 6 in the 1858 treaty is about. And so, mm-hmm. You know, so there it is. And then the other topic, before we took a break, we were talking about these traders and these superintendents and agents. They were all making huge profits, hundreds of thousands of dollars. They become millionaires. I want to go back to the 1851 treaty, back to Henry Hastings Sibley, who wrote the treaty language. And in that treaty language, at the end of the treaty, after the chief signed it, Sibley and his other trader friends had a separate paper at the end of the table that the chiefs didn't know what that was about, because they thought it was other. They had to put their signature on all these papers. So the last paper was Sibley and the trader's papers that they didn't know about it. They signed. Well, they find out a week later that they signed a paper for the traders to get the money for any back payments that the Dakota people might have owed them previously. And so that money would be taken out of the profits of the land when the land was sold. So the traders got paid for any past money that was owed them. And Henry Hastings Sibley put in his report to be reimbursed for $145,000. In today's money, that would be over $4 million. So Henry Hastings Sibley became a millionaire in 1851, because the government reimbursed him from the Dakota land for $145,000. $4 million in today's.
Wow.
Yes. And so that's what the Indian system is about. They're making huge profits. So then Article 6 comes along in the 58 Treaty, and it's all set up for a war to happen, so they can sit back and do nothing and wait for a war to happen and let the Dakota people starve. And the traders wanted to, through the Indian system, wanted their money, so they're waiting for the gold shipment to come in too. So we're not going to give you any food until we get our money. So you can, as the trader said, one of the agent traders said, if you're hungry, then go eat your own dung. Or if you're hungry, go eat grass. That's what he told the warriors and the chiefs at a meeting two days before the war started. And so this is what happened. And I want to get back to the element of the governor of Minnesota, Ramsey. Governor Ramsey, I want to get back to the element of the agents that were, the representative of Washington was sent to do an investigation in 1861, 100 days, about the fraud and the laws being violated to the Dakota people. He made his report, reported that back to Washington, sent a letter to Abraham Lincoln, stating in that letter that if there is nothing, I have found numerous frauds of violations of law and fraud by the agents in Minnesota, and you need to do something immediately, because if it's not corrected, there will be a war that's going to happen. And all hell will come down on the people of Minnesota. And Lincoln got this manuary of 1862, as well as the Secretary of the Interior, all the people in Congress and Senate in the state of Minnesota, they all knew about this letter. And when this agent, George E.H. Day, this agent, went to Washington and talked to the Indian commissioner, requested that I have documents here that proves that they've been stealing money. Can I go into your records that they sent you to get the remaining half of this proof to show that they've been stealing this money? What does that Indian commissioner do? His name was Dole. He says, no, I'm not going to give you them records. And so what could the agent do, George E.H. Day? He couldn't do anything. And so what happens is everything was left. Nothing was ever done in Washington. That was his report was thrown away, and nothing was done. This is in January of 1862, 6 months before the war. In January 1862, Reverends Riggs and Williamson, the reverend ministers that were here on our reservations here in Upper Sioux, they write a report to the state of Minnesota, the representatives, saying that there have been violations going on here, and you got to correct this, or there's going to be a war happening. The state of Minnesota didn't listen, the governor or the representatives of Minnesota. The legislatures. This was in January of 1862. In August 14th of 1862, the people of Mankato and New Ulm got together and wrote a letter to the governor, Ramsey, that please do something immediately to help the Dakota people, because they're starving, they're talking about war. We need for you to protect their lives of the people of Minnesota, the citizens out here in the frontier. They sent that to Ramsey on August 14th. What did Ramsey do? He did nothing. He did not listen to his sworn oath of office, which states that you must protect the lives of the citizens of the state of Minnesota.
Another thing a lot of people may not realize is that Indigenous people were not recognized as citizens until the 1920s.
No, they weren't. But they were recognized as governments to governments through the treaties.
Right.
And the treaty language, the United States was bound to protect the rights through the laws that were in the laws of the United States would be effective for the Indigenous people as well.
Uh-huh.
So they had the responsibility to protect the Dakota people through the treaties. So Ramsey and the legislatures and the representative of Minnesota did not obey their sworn oath. They did not listen to the people of New Ulm and the Brown County to protect them. And therefore, the government was the cause of this war. All the governor had to do was say, let's get on the telegraph, send a letter, a notice to Washington. We'll get to talk immediately to the military here in Minnesota. We'll have to order them agents to open up the warehouses to feed the Dakota people so there won't be any more, so that the citizens of Minnesota will be protected. That's my sworn oath as governor. That's your sworn oath as the legislature. That's your sworn oath as a representative from Minnesota to Washington to protect the lives of the citizens of the state of Minnesota.
Right.
If they do that, no. Therefore, they caused the War of 1862. They were well notified. For years they knew the Indians about the Indian system. Washington knew about the Indian system. All the senators and House representatives knew about the Indian system. The law being violated. They did nothing. So that is what caused this war. And they can depend on Article 6 and 1858 Treaty to cut back and do nothing until the young warriors are tired and are angry to watch their people starve. That is the cause of this war. And who gets to blame when the war starts and after the war? The media gets involved. They say the heathen savages are scalping and robbing and raping and killing the women of Minnesota. Oh, they're just terrible. And then what are the people? Well, then we have a right to just annihilate them. They want to just take all the Dakotas out of Minnesota. They need to do that
uh-huh.
now. Yeah, we have our excuse. Yeah. And justify the means. That's exactly what they did. And for our Dakota people, a lot of people I know, this was all pre-planned. The history proves it. The research we have done and the language that's in that research has proved it. Indirectly. And I'm sure there's some direct letters that we have still not have found yet that can prove it. There were some good people in St. Paul, Minneapolis that said it themselves that are not Indian. It was a pre-planned process to get the Dakota land and remove them. That's written down.
So, you know, with all this, you know, laying in the history, where do you see the Dakota people moving forward in the next 150 years?
Well, first of all, I think we need, through this documentary and through the educational system, we need to educate the people of Minnesota and, for that matter, throughout this country and the world, which is one reason why we're doing this documentary. The other
uh-huh.
thing is I'd like to recommend the people to there's a book called Lincoln and the Indians, Civil War Policy and Politics by Professor David A. Nichols. If you get this book, actually we talked the Minnesota Historical Society in a few months ago to reprint this book. It has been
mm-hmm.
out of print since 2000. I've been working with Professor Nichols. I've interviewed him on his book because Professor Nichols deals with the Indian system. He did a thorough research in 1978 when this book was released on this whole Indian system I've been talking about. Everything that I've been saying is verified, and even there's more in this book as to the Indian system in Minnesota and in Washington and how they dealt with indigenous people. So I will really recommend your audience to get this book, Lincoln and the Indians, Civil War Policy and Politics, by David A. Nichols. The Minnesota Historical Society has reprinted that. It's supposed to be out this in May now. It should be out by now or in any day now. It should be. They'll have it on sale at the Historical Society in St. Paul. And you can.
You know, a lot of times people think, you know, why do we study history? I mean, it's all, you know, in the past. But there's an old saying about those who forget history are doomed to repeat it. And, you know, I think that's probably the biggest lesson that we need to take away is that, you know, this happened and it was a bad thing. And we need to make sure that nothing like this ever happens again.
Yes, it's about truth telling. It's about, which is why we have, as Dakota people and other indigenous people are trying to explain our history, really caused these wars in the Indian system and the process that went across this whole country to get our land. This is what happened to us. That has never been clearly taught to the students, to the history books. We need to become real human beings with dignity and respect. We all need to hear the real truth about history, because only then we can become real human beings and respect one another. That's mm-hmm. what has been lacking in this country from day one. And so if the real history is taught in high school and college about what really happened in our history to the indigenous people in North and South America, then hopefully they can get the understanding of what truth is really about. They can identify in themselves as a human being about what respect and understanding really should be about the indigenous people. They suffer tremendously with all their terrible racist history written about them as heathen savages. And that brings me to the point of the doctrine of Christian discovery. This is going to be my next segment in this documentary.
Uh-huh.
The doctrine of Christian discovery started with the Papal Bulls in the 14th century. The Papal Bulls by the Pope gave Isabel and Ferdinand of Spain and Portugal the right to find any country out there, and if there are any people on it, then that gave them if they weren't Christian, then that gave them the right, then that made them heathen savages, and that gave them the right to either enslave them. And if they wouldn't become Christian, then they could either enslave them or kill them. And so through this doctrine of Christian discovery, then, that's what gave them the right to take the lands of the indigenous peoples in South America and North America. And through this system, then, France and Great Britain and the other European countries monarchs said, well, we're Christians too. So we'll use the doctrine of Christian discovery, because we've now landed on Plymouth Rock. We're going to use that same system of discovery, the doctrine of Christian discovery, with our moral values, because these are just heathages. And so if they're not Christian, then that's what they are. That gives us the right, then, as Christians, to take their lands. And that's exactly what they did. And so when we fought the British in the Revolutionary War, and then we formulated a government in 1776, then they made their laws through that governance. And then through that governance, they created the Supreme Court justice system to write down the laws dealing with the indigenous people and their land. You have to remember, the European people that were landed in South America and in North America, they hated the indigenous people because we had the land and they did not. And so they used any means possible to justify the means, and used the doctrine of discovery to do that.
A lot of people's impression of indigenous people is essentially they were hanging around virtually naked, banging on drums and gnawing on bones, living in teepees. And they have no idea that they had cultures and civilizations and trade relationships and governments and religion, all the other things that also existed in Europe and Asia and so forth and so on, but they did exist here.
They used the Iroquois system and other indigenous people from back east. They used their system of democracy to start the democracy in this country.
Right.
They used that as the foundation of democracy. And so if we were just run around with breechcloths on, we didn't have a system of democracy that they used, what does that mean? It's just crazy. It's just, that's a form of ethnocentric way of belief. That's another thing with it. They had to make the indigenous people look unintelligent, because their superiority then would step forward. And then they could use that to accomplish what they had to accomplish.
And that brainwashing was done on everyone. And it continued. I mean, it didn't stop with the treaty in 1858 or the war of 1862 or anything else. That same mindset, I mean, it was taught to people. You're going to America where they have these redskin natives who are a bunch of savages, blah, 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 blah. So people were being taught this, and it was being passed down from generation to generation, so that when contact first occurred between the two sides, these European descendant settlers hated them from the beginning.
Well, you have to remember, the reason the Europeans left Europe is they were tired of their religious wars. They want to have their own independence to form their own religious belief systems. So they came to the United States with their belief that we want to believe in our own way of the Bible, so to speak. So the Christian value system would be under our control, and we can start our own groups, our own Methodists and Episcopals and Baptists and all of them. And so that's what they did. Isn't that ironic? They come here for freedom of religion, and that they deny the indigenous people their spiritual rights and ceremonies? That's terrible. And so
there's
another example.
They wanted freedom of religion, but they only wanted freedom for their way, apparently.
Exactly. And so when we say this as indigenous people, oh, you're an angry Indian person. Oh, that's just terrible. Yeah, right. Why don't you write the real history? Why don't you read the real history? Or somebody write it and really get down into telling the whole truth. This is what we're talking about, truth in history. Why? This is why America has such a black clouds hanging over them, because of what they did to the indigenous people and the way they went about doing that. That is a terrible way to start a country. That's why the black cloud will always be hanging over them until they get together and say, look, we're sorry, look. We got to really look at this history in the proper way. We got to change these history books. We got to tell the truth for humanity's sake. And when we do that, we're going to be all a better people in the 21st century. That's what this is about.
As mainstream America tries to begin to understand the indigenous people's culture and ways and so forth and so on, and reach a more normal relationship between the two cultures. This question comes in through email, and question, let me see if I can find it again here now. What do you think about the people that protest names like the Cleveland Indians and Washington Redskins and Atlanta Braves and other sports teams, and even corporations that use representations of Native peoples?
Yeah, that's the mascot issue. I think that's a terrible thing. It's a terrible thing. our children are going to watch the Cleveland Indians with a terrible red Indian face, a cartoon face on there. What if we put a cartoon face of Abraham Lincoln, making him look ugly and total pale face with big pimples on him? Would they like that and call them the Abraham Lincoln Washington, D.C. Senators? I mean, it's the mentality of people. They have no respect for the dignity of indigenous people. We have a beautiful culture and a beautiful way from the beginning of time up to this very moment in our future. And our children should not have to watch television and watch be insulted by these nicknames. We're not a nickname. We're human beings. We're beings with a vast amount of history and all we gave to this country and this continent. All the things that the people are living on today that we've had and we've shared in a good way, all of those should be respected. And to have the indignant pieces of mascots on these teams, it's just totally not right. This angers me. You know, I'm a Vietnam veteran. I'm 65 years old. And uh-huh. I fought for my people, my Dakota people, all our people, for our land and the life that is here for our people. And all the other aspects, too, that we're protecting what we have left and we're protecting what we've shared with everybody else in this country. And for that matter, even in Canada. And so we have a responsibility as elders, responsibility as veterans to say what is wrong. We didn't fight and put our lives on our line to have this indignant thing, this indignity processes of mascots for our children to watch on TV and be embarrassed about. That's awful. So it just goes on and on and on. When is the respect for indigenous people ever going to happen?
And you know, for people that would like to learn more about who the Dakota people were 150 years ago, as well as who they are today, what kind of resources are there available? I mean, you know, obviously we don't have something coming from Hollywood.
Well, I
can't think of a very good representation offhand that has come from there.
I've been involved in the film industry from Hollywood since 1971 when I got back from Vietnam and end of 1970. Uh-huh. I spent all these years in the film industry, which is why I'm a filmmaker now, too. So, which is why I'm doing this documentary, so that that these Hollywood images can change. You know, uh-huh. We have an indigenous image of Hollywood was awful. So hopefully, myself as an artist can change some of that through documentaries, and that's what I'm trying to do. Educate people uh-huh. as who we really are. I've been filming our elders for many years about their oral stories, their oral history stories of our people. And so I'm documenting those oral stories so that our children and their children can have those oral stories from our elders. Because they're passing on, and when they pass on, all those stories are gone. So
now, you know, in terms of the Dakota language, is there a problem with language preservation? Are there still lots of native speakers of the language? Or is it in danger of dying out, too?
No, it's in danger of dying out. We're trying to preserve that now. And so uh-huh. A lot of the colleges and universities have the language in their curriculum, which is really good. And there are other of our people are starting their own nonprofits for language. We're doing it, and with the media system today, we can go on, you know, we can go online or go through process of learn our language. And that's what we're doing now. We're trying to preserve all of that. So, yeah, it's happening. It's definitely happening. But so it's coming along well. Not as fast as we wanted to, but it's coming along. And so we are doing something to preserve that, yes.
Okay. Well, I know that it was a lot of tribes. We had a lady on a few weeks ago, and she was saying there was one native speaker of the language was left with the one particular group. And that's like really almost extinct language. I mean, that doesn't mean that the native speaker, that was her first language, versus somebody who speaks it as a second language. But without native speakers, you know, can a language really stay alive if you're not completely fluent in it?
Well,
so preserving that is important.
Yeah, and that, which is why we can, what's why we're filming, we are filming elders speaking the language so that we preserve that on film. So we have some people are interviewing our, have an elder, a man and a woman talking our language and talking back and forth to one another and speaking Dakota only. And so, so we're preserving it through that way. Others individually talking Dakota and saying, what I'm saying now in this sentence is this, and this is how you say it in Dakota. That's what we're preserving through filming. So that process is really good for us because we can preserve our language through that process, through the media.
Now, how about as far as written materials about the Dakota history or any indigenous people? Are you aware of any projects where these materials are being produced, say, for schools from elementary on up?
Well, you know, that's really, you know, this is the first time in 150 years that we're telling our story here in Minnesota as Dakota people. And so hopefully from what this 150-year event is this year, it's going to wake up. We're going to educate in Minnesota and the authorities and the education systems to say, okay, we got to correct this injustice. We got to correct this whole relook at this whole system of education and re a whole different manner and work with the Dakota people, those that are educated in specific education degrees and others to tell the stories. We'll put these stories in. We'll tell the history in a proper way, in a good way. And that's what we need to do this year. And hopefully that's what the message is going to be this summer as we head into August, when the war started on August 18th here. The state of Minnesota and the representatives, the governor and everybody that's in charge, has to come up with a statement. What are they going to do? They're going to look at the past history and have to make a statement about the Dakota people, what happened to them in this state. So this documentary,
now, most areas have some sort of a historical society and whatnot. Do the Dakota people have their own historical society?
Of course not. No.
Well, I would think that would be an important part of any group, whether it's a tribe or any other sort of group, to have some sort of historian recording things as well as passing on things.
Well, we do have our Dakota historians. We do preserve that, but we have a, here on our reservation, we have an interpretive center where we have it's like a historical society, but it's our history. Yes, we do have that.
Oh, okay. I guess I didn't phrase the question real well. But, yeah, because I was thinking, well, you know, every tribe should have one. If they don't, they should.
Well, they do.
Because, you know, to educate their own children as well as outsiders who are like, hey, you know, I'd like to know some more about this.
Oh, yeah. A lot of tribes do. A lot of them do. And they are preserving them. So that's something that's positive that is happening or has been happening. You know, so a lot of, remember though, we've only had 33 years of understanding and the right to do our own spiritual ceremonies and practice that. So we've come a long way in only 33 years. So we're going ahead, walking, going forward, and putting all these things together. Our own stories, like I'm doing, and a lot of others are doing it as well, interviewing their elders and putting them on film and on tape, on DVD form, and digital formats, and preserving them.
So when do you anticipate your documentary being released?
Hopefully by July, in July.
Of this year?
The first segment on the cause of the War of 1862 is almost completed. I just have a couple more edits to include in that. And then I'll be using that to be showing to different groups. And while I complete this next segment on the Doctrine of Discovery.
Uh-huh, see? Yep. Now,
yeah,
do you have a website?
That's what I'm going to, once I get almost finished with that, we'll start the website.
Okay, all right. You'll have to keep us updated, and we'll put it on the Exogeny Network website. We're down to just a couple of minutes now before the end of the program. So is there anything you want to say in that last couple of minutes?
Well, you know, there's another documentary called we did a horse ride. It's called Dakota 38. You can go online.
Uh-huh.
Go online. It does have a internet. What did you just say it was? I'm sorry, my mind is. It does have an internet. You can go online.
Website, a web page.
Website, yes, website. So it's called the Dakota 38, and it's a horse ride that we do every year in December. The 38 Dakota men were hung on December 26th, the day after Christmas, in Mankato. And we do a spiritual horse ride from South Dakota through Lower Sioux, where I am at, where the war started, and where they took the prisoners to Mankato to be hung. And so we do a horse ride in their memory. We start in South Dakota and ride, end up on December 26th. And have a ceremony at the hanging site. There were also two other Dakota men that were hung 3 years later on November 11th, 1865. One of them was my grandfather, Medicine Bottle, and Chief Medicine Bottle, and another chief, Little Six. They were hung because they fought in the War of 1862 as well. There was no proof in that trial that there was no witnesses that they killed anybody, but they hung them anyway. And so my grandpa was another one that was hung. My uncle was hung, was beat to death going from Lower Sioux to Mankato in an ox cart. Him and four other warriors had their hands and their ankles tied in an ox cart, taken to the stockade in Mankato. They were beat to death going by a town called New Alum. And so these things go on and on, but it's not about, there has to be some healing here. And so this horse ride is about healing. This ceremony is about healing and how we can get rid of this generational trauma that has been in our Dakota people since the War of 1862. And so we're dealing through ceremony of getting rid of that and looking at the truths and through ceremony so we can heal from that and let part of that go. So that this generational trauma will be released little at a time for healing. And that's what our ceremonies do. And so if they can go online,
I just pulled up that website on a search. It's smoothfeather.org/Dakota38/. For people who want to pull that up. Once again, it's smoothfeather.org/Dakota38/. And that'll pull up, and they've got a little trailer and everything there.
Mm-hmm. So this is about healing for all of us. I think that's the last message I'd like to leave. Let's look at truth in history. Let's heal from it some way through that. We've got to, as human beings. And so for all humanity and for our children's future, let's look at the truth and through history, and let's deal with it, and let's respect one another through history, what really happened.
Yeah, because greater understanding, you know, is going to lead to a real peace rather than just a truce between everyone. And that's important. If we're going to get through the next millennium together, we need to reach a real peace and mutual respect.
Yep, and healing through that process.
Mm-hmm. And I think your documentary is going to be a good step into reaching that understanding. Now, when you're distributing the documentary, how can people see it or get it or whatever? Is it going to be through universities? Is it going to be released? You know, how's it going to be released, or do you know that yet?
Yeah, well, I'm working through that process now. Ultimately, I would like to get it on through the television, HBO, or something through that process first, and do that process. Of course, we'll be setting up viewings through universities and that as well. And so that's the process I'm looking into, and so sooner or later, hopefully sooner, that the people will be able to watch it on television.
Yep, so people keep checking on exogenynetwork.com because, Sheldon, you got to make sure you give us an update on how to get this, how to see this video, where it's going to be released and whatnot, and we will make sure that it's well. And with that, folks, we are down to the last minute, so I want to thank everybody for listening tonight. And I hope that it has given everyone plenty of food for thought, as well as more illumination for your personal journey towards truth. Join us again next week as we continue our Native American Voices series and hear another voice with another story to share with us all. It's sure to be another program that is just as thought-provoking. Thank you once again, Sheldon, for coming on the program tonight and being such a wonderful and informative guest.
Thank you very much.
Folks, been listening to The Dawn of Shades. I'm your host, Gia Scott, and good night.